This episode continues that chapter of church history marked by what's called scholasticism. Now, scholasticism was an intellectual movement and educational approach that dominated medieval European universities from the 12th to the 16th centuries. It was a systematic attempt to reconcile classical philosophy, particularly the work of Aristotle, with Christian theology and doctrine. Begun by the early work of Gerbert, and then later by Peter Abelard and Anselm of Canterbury that we looked at in the last episode, scholasticism came into its own as a movement when the Greek philosopher Aristotle was rediscovered by scholars in Europe. The Crusades had made contact with Muslim scholars who debated Aristotle's philosophy. Their thoughts returned with the Crusaders and were passed on to the theological schools located in the mendicant orders of the Dominicans and Franciscans. Now, these were the groups that the church had invested with the study of theology. During the mid-13th century, there was something of an Aristotelian revival in these schools. It's interesting that at the dawn of the 13th century, reading Aristotle was forbidden. After all, he was a pagan. What could Christians learn from him? But as any college knows, there's one way to make sure something gets read. That's to ban it or prohibit it. So a couple of decades later, portions of Aristotle were grudgingly allowed to be read. And by mid-century, he was required reading. Both he and his mentor Plato and his teacher Socrates were unofficially baptized and kind of made over into pre-Christian saints. Now, it makes sense that Aristotle's philosophy would be resurrected for the scholastics when we remember that the goal that they had was to apply reason to faith, to seek to understand with the rational mind what the Spirit already believed. Aristotle was the one who developed the rules of logic. During the Middle Ages in Europe, all learning took place under the watchful eye of the church. Theology reigned supreme among the sciences. Philosophers like Aristotle and the Muslim Averroes, Jewish Maimonides, were studied alongside the Bible. Scholars were especially fascinated by Aristotle because he seemed to have explained the universe not by using scripture, but by the powers of observation and reason. For some ultra-conservatives, this emphasis on reason threatened to undermine traditional belief. Christians had come to think that knowledge could only come through God's revelation, that only those to whom God chose to reveal truth could understand the universe. So how could this be squared with the knowledge taught by these, well, newly rediscovered philosophies that had been developed by pagans? The pinnacle of scholastic theology arrived with Thomas Aquinas. His work forever shaped the direction of Roman Catholicism. His influence was so profound that he was given the title Doctor Angelicus, the Angelic Doctor. Aquinas was born in 1225 in Rocca Secca, Italy, to Count Lundolf of Aquino and his wife Theodora. He was the youngest of nine, and it was clear at a young age that he would be big. And by big, I mean in size. At five, he was sent to school at the nearby monastery of Monte Cassino, started by Benedict 700 years earlier. At the age of 19, Thomas went to the University of Naples, where his Dominican teacher so impressed him, Thomas decided that he too would join the new, study-oriented Dominican order. Now, his family fiercely opposed this. They had hoped that he would become a wealthy abbot or archbishop rather than take the mendicant's vow of poverty. Thomas's brothers kidnapped him. They confined him for a year. His family went so far as to tempt him with a prostitute and to offer to buy him the Archbishopric of Naples. But Thomas would have none of it. He went to Paris, the medieval Europe's headquarters of theological study. And there he came under the spell of the Dominican scholar Albert the Great, better known by his Latin name Albertus Magnus. When Thomas began his studies, no one would suspect the future that lay before him. He was colossally obese, and much of his size due to edema. Then it was known as dropsy. He had one huge eye that dwarfed the other and gave his face a distorted aspect that many people found disconcerting. Socially, Thomas was anything but the dynamic, charismatic figure that some might assume, you know, something to make up for his awkward physical appearance. No, Aquinas was so introspective and silent most of the time that no one could figure him out. And when he did speak, what he said often had nothing to do with the conversation at hand. In college, his classmates called him the dumb ox, a title that seemed apropos for both his appearance and his behavior. But what people didn't realize till much later was the incredibly keen mind behind the unassuming exterior and the brilliant way that he was able to marshal his thoughts into persuasive language that others could easily understand. Remember that the goal of the Scholastics was to provide a rational understanding to what Christians believed. Aquinas gave critical support to this endeavor in such doctrines as the attributes of God, the resurrection, and ex nihilo creation, that is, creation out of nothing. While these things are things that most Christians hold to, Aquinas also provided support for distinctly Roman Catholic beliefs, like the veneration of Mary, purgatory, the role of human merit in salvation, and the seven sacraments by which God conveys grace through the Roman clergy. He also gave much support to transubstantiation, the idea that the communion elements are turned into the literal body and blood of Christ in the Mass. Now, his theological and philosophical musings covered a wide range from metaphysics to ethics, and politics, and of course, theology. Socially awkward, he frequently drifted into the internal world of his mind, where he became oblivious to what was happening around him. And according to one account, as he dined with Francis's King Louis IX, as others were engaging conversation, Thomas just stared off into space, lost in thought. Now, either forgetting or not caring where he was, he slammed his fist on the table and shouted, "Ah, there's an argument that will destroy the Manichaeans." Now, you may remember, the Manichaeans were a heretical group from centuries before. No one was battling them at that time, and no one at the table had been talking about them. Though seated at the same table as the King of France and other important dignitaries, Aquinas was obviously mentally someplace else. He was heavily influenced by Aristotelian philosophy, which he studied during his time in Paris, but all of that was shaped by traditional Christian theology, particularly of the Augustine frame. One of the most important contributions that Aquinas made to philosophical inquiry came from his long pondering on being as in existence. He differentiated between the being that is the objective sense and reality of a thing, in Latin the esse naturale, and the expression of that thing as it's perceived in the mind, the esse intentionale. Aquinas argued that essence precedes perception and is the foundation of all being. Now, discussion around Aquinas's position on being becomes one of the central debates of later philosophy and perhaps the main divide between modernity and postmodernism. I ask that you indulge me a moment as I unpack that a little bit, because it may help explain a fundamental difference between modernity and postmodernity. Modernity was shaped around the premise that the rational mind was capable of seeing things as they really are. It held forth the idea that there is an objective reality that exists apart from the mind, and that the goal of all right thinking was to align the mind with that objective reality. Truth wasn't whatever someone wanted to believe or even wanted to be true. Truth existed as an objective fact, and it was the duty of humans to align their thoughts with that. Now, through a series of clever word games played by later skeptics like David Hume, postmodernity decided that it was impossible to be objective about an objective reality because all we can do is think about it. Therefore, whatever one chooses to believe as true is true. For the postmodern, reality is only a mental construct. In postmodernism, there is no reality outside the mind. Truth is a subjective desire for a thing to be. With Aquinas' insistence on an objective reality that exists independently of the mind, he'd have a hard time finding a job in most secular universities or major media newsrooms today. Maybe he could get a job at the Daily Wire and work alongside Jordan Peterson. Aquinas' work on ethics flows from the idea of natural law. He reasoned that human beings have a natural inclination towards certain good things, like life, knowledge, relationships. These good things are objectively good and part of the natural law. That is the moral law that governs all human behavior. For Aquinas, that which is good is that which leads ultimately to human flourishing. In this, he aligned with some of the more refined ancient Greek philosophers. Thomas's political ideas flowed naturally from his ethics. If ethics were centered on individual good, politics was based on the common good. He maintained that the purpose of civil government was to promote the common good, but he made a distinction between divine law and human law. While both laws aim at human flourishing, divine law relates primarily to morality and was revealed by God, while human law was derived by people working in concert, working together in order to fashion a society that would promote behaviors to promote the common good. Aquinas' theological magnum opus was called Summa Theologica. It begins by distinguishing between philosophy and theology, reason and revelation. Now, contrary to what some had claimed, true theology and philosophy do not contradict each other. Each are avenues of knowledge ordained by God. Following Aristotle's lead, Thomas proposed that reason is based on what our senses tell us, that is, what we can see, feel, hear, smell, touch. Revelation is based on more. While reason can lead us to belief in God, something other theologians like Anselm had already said, only revelation can show us God as he really is, the God who reveals himself in the Bible. Philosophy makes clear the existence of God, but only theology based on revelation tells us what the God who exists is like. Thomas accepted Aristotle's principle that every effect has a cause and every cause a prior cause, and so on back to the first cause. He declared creation traces back to a divine first cause, the Creator. However, the full knowledge of God, the Trinity, for example, comes only through revelation. From this knowledge, we discover man's origin and destiny. Aquinas went on, man is a sinner in need of special grace from God. By his sacrifice, Jesus Christ has secured the reconciliation of a holy God and sinful man. All who receive the benefits of Christ's work are justified. But the key, as in traditional Roman Catholic teaching, lies in the way the benefits of Christ's work are applied. Christ won grace, but the Church imparts it. Aquinas taught that Christians need the constant infusion of what he called cooperating grace, whereby Christian virtues are stimulated in the soul. Assisted by this cooperating grace, a Christian can do works that please God and gain special merit in God's sight. This grace, said Aquinas, comes to people only through the divinely appointed sacraments placed in the keeping of the Church, by which he meant the visible, organized Roman Church, led by the magisterium, headed, of course, by the Pope. So convinced was Aquinas of the divine authority of the papacy, he insisted submission to the Pope was necessary for salvation. Now, following an earlier scholastic, Peter of Lombard, Aquinas held to seven sacraments as the means by which the Church imparts grace to people. He said, since sin remains a problem for the baptized believer, God provided penance, which was a sacrament that allowed for spiritual healing. With some caution, Thomas also accepted the practice of indulgences that had gained acceptance during the Crusades. Aquinas taught that, thanks to the work of Christ and the meritorious deeds of the saints, the Church had access to a kind of treasury of merit, a kind of great spiritual reservoir of excess goodness. And priests were able to draw from this reservoir and dispense it to Christians who had insufficient merit of their own. Now, think of the treasury of merit this way. There are some cooperative health insurance programs that have been established whereby people make payments into a fund that acts as a kind of reservoir of capital. When those who have contributed have a medical need, they apply to a gatekeeper steward who decides if a request for financial assistance is merited. Well, the Treasury of Merit works somewhat like that, except the only contributors to the Treasury were saints and especially holy people who'd produced an excess of good, the excess in this case being beyond what they needed to merit the qualification of obtaining saving grace. So if that sounds contrary to the New Testament's gospel of grace, welcome to the debate that will later tear the Church in two during the Reformation. Obviously, we're going to be coming back to this subject of indulgences when we get to that period of Church history. Aquinas said that the wicked pass into hell, while the faithful who've wisely used the means of grace pass immediately to heaven. But the bulk of Christians who'd followed Christ inadequately had to suffer purification in a purgatory before ascending to the joys of heaven. Thankfully, these souls are not beyond the help of the Church on earth. Prayers to saints and special masses could relieve the pains of souls in purgatory. There was, quite frankly, nothing new in all of this. It had been said many times before. But Thomas set the traditional teaching of the Church in a cosmic framework. He came up with reasons for it. Now, his writings, and there were more than what were contained in the Summa Theologica, were attacked before he was even in his grave. In 1277, the Archbishop of Paris tried to have Thomas condemned, but the Roman clergy put a stop to it. Though Thomas was canonized in 1325, it took another 200 years before his teaching was hailed as preeminent and a major rebuttal to Protestantism. His works played a prominent role in the Counter-Reformation's Council of Trent. While Aquinas was prized for his writings and teaching, to his delight, he was never made a bishop. He was known to blend deep meditations on theology with personal devotions so intense, he became oblivious to what was happening around him. And over the years, he had numerous visions. But one in early December of 1273, while celebrating Mass, saw him in a prolonged ecstasy that ended his attempts to put his ideas into writing. When his secretary begged him to pick up his pen and continue, Aquinas replied, quote, "I cannot. Such things have been revealed to me that what I have written seems but straw," unquote. So his Summa Theologica, one of the most influential writings in church history, was left unfinished when he died 3 months later. In 1879, a papal bull endorsed Aquinas' theology, today known as Thomism, as an authentic expression of doctrine, and said that it should be studied by all students of theology. Both Protestant and Catholic scholars study his work deeply to this day.